A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's perfectly timed, because I spent yesterday with my head inside a drop ceiling, running Ethernet cable through an apartment that was built sometime during the British Mandate and hasn't seen a renovation since. And somewhere between the third snag cable and the discovery that the previous tenant had used masking tape as a structural material, I had this thought, this exact moment of sweaty, improvised, probably inadvisable self-reliance might be the most Zionist thing I've done all year.
That's not where I expected you to go with a cable story. I thought you were going to complain about the plaster dust.
Oh, I will complain about the plaster dust. But Daniel's prompt got me thinking. He and Hannah are in the middle of a move, too, doing more themselves than they'd like, partly for economic reasons, partly because sometimes it's the only way to get things done in this city. And he had this realization that being in Jerusalem, figuring out how to move your own furniture and run your own cables and solve problems with whatever's in the toolbox, that's not just a practical response to a high cost of living. It's the realization of a specific ideological project.
The new Jew?
Daniel put it this way. The early Zionists rebelled against the image of the diaspora. Jew. Weak. Passive. At the mercy of surrounding societies. Whether that image was a fair characterization or not, it drove a century-long project to create something oppositional. The Israeli Jew who is strong, resourceful, capable. And that extends far beyond DIY into every facet of life. He wants us to unpack how that debate was articulated, for people who don't know the story.
We're going to trace this from a speech in Basel in 1898. Max Nordau coining the term Muskel Judentum, Muscle Judaism, all the way to you in a drop ceiling in Jerusalem, covered in plaster dust, enacting a 128-year-old vision of who you're supposed to be.
Without knowing it.
Without knowing it, which is exactly the point. That's when ideology has really won, when it stops feeling like ideology and just feels like Tuesday.
Let's back up. What exactly was this vision of the new Jew, and where did it come from?
The thing to understand is that this wasn't a subtle cultural shift. It was a deliberate, explicit program of re-engineering what it meant to be Jewish. The early Zionists looked at the diaspora condition and said, "We're not just building a state, we're building a new kind of person."
Which is an astonishingly ambitious thing to attempt. Most national movements just want borders and a flag. These guys wanted to redesign the Jewish body.
The Jewish mind. That's what Daniel's prompt is really getting at. It wasn't enough to move Jews to Palestine and give them citizenship. The argument was that centuries of exile had produced a specific kind of damage. Jews had been forced into narrow economic niches, barred from land ownership and trades, pushed into commerce and intellectual work. The result, they believed, was a population that had lost the capacity for physical competence.
The solution wasn't just political sovereignty. It was a total re-education in being capable.
Learning to build instead of hire, to carry instead of delegate, to fix instead of endure. The early agricultural schools, Mikveh Israel, was founded in 1870, nearly three decades before the first Zionist Congress even met, weren't just about teaching farming techniques. They were laboratories for a new Jewish character.
That's where Daniel's cable running moment connects. He's not thinking about Herzl when he's trying to figure out how to snake wire through a concrete wall, but the cultural assumption that he should be able to figure it out, that hiring someone is almost a failure of resourcefulness. That's the inheritance.
The ideology did its job so thoroughly that it disappeared into instinct. Israelis today don't say, "I'm enacting the Zionist vision," when they fix a leaky faucet. They say, "It's faster to do it myself," or, "Why pay someone when I can figure it out?" But those aren't neutral economic calculations. They're cultural reflexes with a very specific pedigree.
This matters beyond Israel because it's a case study in something bigger. National identity isn't just flags and anthems. It's encoded into everyday competence. What your culture implicitly teaches you to do yourself versus outsource. That's not random. It's history made flesh.
Or made plaster dust, in your case.
The plaster dust is very real. So let's get into the history. The man who gave this idea its most famous formulation was Max Nordau, and his 1898 speech in Basel is where we need to start.
He's one of those figures who was enormously influential in his time and is now mostly a footnote outside of Zionist history circles. But in 1898, at the Second Zionist Congress in Basel, he got up and delivered a speech that essentially diagnosed the Jewish body as a political problem.
Which is a strange thing to hear from a doctor, in a way. You'd expect a physician to treat the body as a medical issue, not a national one.
Nordau was both. He was a physician and a social critic. He'd already written a book called Degeneration, about what he saw as the physical and moral decline of European civilization. So when he turned his attention to the Jewish question, he brought that diagnostic lens with him. His argument was that the diaspora had not just scattered Jews geographically, it had deformed them physically. Centuries of exclusion from land, from manual labor, from the full range of human activity had produced what he saw as a narrow, stooped, physically degraded population.
He coined a term for the solution.
The phrase itself is almost a provocation. It takes the anti-Semitic caricature of the weak, bookish Jew and says, fine, we'll make that impossible. We'll rebuild the Jewish body from the ground up. His exact words were, and I'm translating here, we must once again accustom our limbs to the joy of physical exertion. We must become deep-chested, sturdy, sharp-eyed men.
Deep-chested, sturdy, sharp-eyed men. That's quite a specific shopping list.
It is, and you can hear the 19th century nationalism in it. This is the era of physical culture movements across Europe. Gymnastics clubs, sports associations, the idea that national strength required bodily strength. Nordau was plugging Zionism into that broader current, but he added something specific to the Jewish case, the argument that physical regeneration wasn't just healthy, it was a prerequisite for political sovereignty. You couldn't build a state with a population that had been systematically excluded from building things.
It wasn't just about sports. It was about a complete re-education in what Jews were permitted to do and be.
And this is where the DIY connection really starts to become visible. Nordau and Herzl and the other early Zionist thinkers weren't just saying Jews should go to the gym. They were saying Jews should learn trades, manual labor, agriculture, crafts. The whole economic structure of diaspora Jewish life, concentrated in commerce, finance, intellectual professions, was something they wanted to dismantle and rebuild.
There's a term for this, right? The productivization of Jewish labor.
And the concept that went with it was the Luftmensch, literally air person, someone without solid economic grounding, floating between occupations, never rooted in productive work. This was the critique the Zionists leveled at diaspora Jewish economic life. The solution, in their view, was to create a Jewish proletariat and peasantry, classes that barely existed in the diaspora because Jews had been structurally barred from them.
Which is a fascinating inversion. Most political movements of the time were trying to lift people out of the working class. The Zionists were trying to put Jews into it.
Because they saw it as the only path to genuine self-sufficiency. And they didn't just talk about it, they built institutions. Mitva Israel, the agricultural school, was founded in 1870, nearly 3 decades before the first Zionist Congress. The Technion in Haifa, cornerstone laid in 1912, was conceived as a school for practical engineering and trades, not just abstract science. The Hashomer Hatzair youth movement, founded in 1913, made physical labor and self-sufficiency central to its educational program.
The first Hebrew gymnasium in Jaffa, 1906.
And the Bar Giora self-defense groups around the same period. The point is, this was a coordinated institutional push. It wasn't just rhetoric. They were building a pipeline from ideology to practice.
Here's the tension I want to sit with for a moment. Nordau's diagnosis of the weak diaspora Jew. How much of that was a response to real vulnerability, and how much was an internalization of anti-Semitic stereotypes?
It's both, and that's what makes it uncomfortable. The vulnerability was real. Pogroms in the Russian Empire, economic marginalization across Europe, exclusion from guilds and land ownership, these weren't imaginary. Jews were genuinely at the mercy of surrounding societies in ways that made physical self-defense and economic self-sufficiency urgent, but Nordau's language also borrows directly from anti-Semitic imagery. The degenerate Jewish body, the parasitic economic role. These were tropes that anti-Semites had been using for decades.
The new Jew was as much a rejection of a caricature as an embrace of a new ideal. And that means the caricature gets to define the terms either way.
That's the trap. If you define yourself in opposition to a stereotype, you're still letting the stereotype set the agenda. Some later Zionist thinkers recognized this, and tried to reframe the project in more positive terms. Not, we're fixing what's broken, but we're building something new. But Nordau's formulation was the one that stuck, because it had emotional force. It addressed a real sense of humiliation.
That brings us to the practical mechanism. How did this ideology actually become a cultural reflex? Because speeches at congresses don't make people run Ethernet cables a century later. Something had to transmit it.
The kibbutzim and moshavim. These were the laboratories where the ideology became habit. In the early agricultural settlements, every member had to be a generalist, plumber, electrician, builder, farmer. You couldn't call a professional because there wasn't one. You couldn't hire help because there was no money. The survival of the community depended on everyone being able to do everything.
It wasn't optional. It was survival.
And that's the crucible. When competence is a survival requirement, it gets encoded deeply. You teach it to your children not as a philosophy, but as the obvious way to live. By the time the state was founded in 48, you had two generations who had grown up with the assumption that a capable person can build, fix, grow, and defend. That ethos then diffused into the broader Israeli culture through the education system, the military, and the sheer force of example.
Now, in 2026, I'm in a drop ceiling with a cable tester, and it never occurs to me to call an electrician. Not because I'm consciously enacting Nordau's vision, but because the cultural programming is so complete that hiring someone feels almost like a moral failure.
That's when ideology has really won. It stops being a choice and becomes the water you swim in. That water you're swimming in has an economic current, too. Israel's cost of living is punishing. Housing prices have outpaced wages for decades, and labor costs for tradespeople are high. So there's a real financial incentive to do things yourself. But here's what's interesting. Plenty of countries have high costs. Switzerland, Japan, Norway. People there also feel the pinch, but they're far more likely to call a professional.
It's not just economics. The cost of living gives you the reason, but the culture gives you the permission.
The Israeli Central Bureau of Statistics did a survey in 2023. 67% of Israeli households reported doing at least one major home repair themselves in the past year. The OECD average was 42%. That's a 25-point gap. That's not random variation. That's a cultural signal.
You see it in the content Israelis produce. Social media is full of tutorials. How to run Ethernet through concrete walls. How to install your own air conditioner. How to build furniture from pallets. And there's this recurring caption, Rakbi Israel, only in Israel. As if the very fact that you'd attempt this yourself is somehow uniquely Israeli.
Which it's not, objectively. People do DIY everywhere. But the pride in it, the sense that this is part of the national character, that is distinctive, and it's a direct descendant of what we were just describing. The kibbutz generalist, the pioneer who could do everything, that figure is still the implicit cultural ideal.
Here's where we need to talk about the shadow side. Daniel mentioned it in his prompt, with some demands of safety. He knew he had to add that qualifier, because the Israeli DIY ethos has a darker dimension.
The same cultural willingness to attempt anything also produces shoddy electrical work, home accidents, and a reluctance to admit when something is beyond your competence. Israel has higher rates of home accident injuries than many comparable countries. Some of that is simply the volume of DIY attempts, but some of it is the cultural resistance to calling a professional even when you should.
I've seen wiring in Jerusalem apartments that looked like it was done by someone who watched a YouTube tutorial once and decided that was sufficient.
That's the tension. The ethos says, figure it out. But not everything should be figured out at 220 volts. The pioneer model assumed a world where the worst-case scenario was a broken plow. The modern version involves electrical panels, gas lines, structural walls. The stakes are different.
There's another dimension we haven't touched. The new Jew was implicitly male. Deep-chested, sturdy, sharp-eyed men. The strong, capable Israeli was coded masculine from the start.
That coding persisted for decades. The pioneer mythology, the farmer, the soldier, the builder, those were male archetypes. But the reality was always more complicated. Women in the kibbutzim did the same agricultural and construction work as men. Women in the pre-state militias, and later the IDF, learned the same technical skills. The cultural stereotype said DIY was masculine, but the actual practice never was. Today, Israeli women are fully embedded in the DIY culture, especially in contexts where it's normalized, the military, the tech sector, the maker movement. But the stereotype persists in weird ways. You still see hardware stores marketed almost entirely to men. You still hear the phrase, call a guy, as the default. It's a lag. The ideology has evolved faster than the cultural messaging around it.
Let's turn to the diaspora question, because Daniel's prompt raised it directly. He said the image of the weak diaspora, Jew, has some ring of truth to it. That's a loaded claim. How do we handle it honestly?
The stereotype was always a generalization, but it reflected real structural conditions. Jews in much of Europe were excluded from guilds, barred from land ownership, restricted from certain trades for centuries. When you systematically prevent a population from doing physical labor, agriculture, and crafts, you shouldn't be surprised when they end up concentrated in commerce and intellectual professions. That's not inherent in capability. It's structural channeling.
The weakness wasn't a Jewish trait. It was a European policy outcome.
And the Zionists understood this. Nordau's whole argument was that the condition was created by exile, not by Jewish nature. But the distinction got blurred over time, and the stereotype took on a life of its own. By the mid-20th century, you had Israeli Jews looking at diaspora Jews and seeing exactly the figure the Zionists had defined themselves against.
Today, there's an interesting inversion. American Jews, for example, have extremely high rates of professional achievement. Doctors, lawyers, academics, tech entrepreneurs. But if you look at hands-on DIY competence, the rates are lower. Israeli visitors to the U.S. are often surprised by how much Americans hire out. Lawn care, house painting, basic repairs. Things an Israeli would just do, Americans call someone.
Which isn't a moral judgment. It's a different cultural equilibrium. The American model says, specialize, earn enough to hire experts, focus on what you're best at. The Israeli model says, be capable of everything. Hiring is a last resort. Self-reliance is a virtue. Neither is obviously superior. They're just different inheritances.
The military is the transmission belt that keeps this alive. For most Jewish Israelis, IDF service is a crash course in practical resourcefulness. You learn to maintain weapons, repair vehicles, improvise solutions with whatever's available, take initiative when the manual doesn't cover the situation.
The IDF has an entire culture around what they call head. Head, Rosh, in Hebrew. Having Rosh means seeing what needs to be done and doing it without being told. It's the opposite of waiting for instructions. That's not a military skill, it's a life skill, and it translates directly to the civilian world. The soldier who learns to fix a broken radio with tape and ingenuity becomes the civilian who runs his own Ethernet cables without calling an electrician.
The military functions as a kind of national DIY school. 2 or 3 years of mandatory training in the mindset of figure it out.
That's one reason the ethos has survived. Every generation gets a fresh infusion of it. Even as the old kibbutz model fades, even as Israel becomes more urban and high-tech, the military keeps pumping resourcefulness into the cultural bloodstream. You can't opt out of it. It's baked into the formative experience of most Israeli adults.
Which brings us back to Daniel, covered in moving box dust, realizing he's not just relocating furniture. He's participating in a tradition that runs from Nordau's speech in Basel, through the kibbutzim in the IDF, and into every Jerusalem apartment where someone looks at a problem and thinks, I can probably do this myself.
What do we do with this? Understanding the history is interesting, but it also changes how you see the behavior. When you encounter Israeli resourcefulness, in a startup that pivoted 5 times on no funding, in a military operation that worked because someone improvised, in a neighbor who rewired his entire apartment from a YouTube tutorial, recognizing it as cultural inheritance rather than individual personality matters. It wasn't an accident that produced this. It was a deliberate, multi-generational project.
That reframes it. You stop seeing the guy who builds his own furniture as just a cheap DIY enthusiast and start seeing him as the latest iteration of something that's been running for over a century. The kibbutznik who couldn't call a plumber because there wasn't one. The pioneer who learned masonry because the settlement needed walls. He's their descendant, even if he's never heard of Nordo.
Which leads to the second thing. The DIY ethos has real economic benefits, saving money, faster execution, the satisfaction of competence, but it also has real costs. Safety risk when people exceed their actual skill. Burnout from treating every household problem as a personal challenge, a reluctance to delegate that can turn a 2-hour professional job into a weekend of frustration and a crooked shelf.
The sweet spot is selective DIY. Knowing what you can safely do and when to call a professional isn't a failure of the ethos, it's maturity. I can run Ethernet cable. I should not rewire my electrical panel. That distinction is part of being capable rather than performatively capable.
For listeners outside Israel, there's a bigger lesson here about how national identity shapes practical competence. What skills does your culture implicitly teach you to do yourself versus outsource? That's not random. It's history, sedimented into reflex. Americans hire lawn care, Israelis don't. Neither is right or wrong, but both have a story behind them that most people never think to ask about.
Here's the final thought I want to leave on the table. The next time you're struggling with a stubborn IKEA cabinet or running a cable through a wall, ask yourself, am I doing this because it's practical or because I'm enacting a century-old vision of who I'm supposed to be? And if the answer is the second one, is that a problem or is it actually kind of remarkable that an idea from a speech in Basel still has enough force to make me crawl into a drop ceiling on a Tuesday? There's a question that sticks with me after all this. Israel is becoming more economically stratified. The tech wealth in Tel Aviv, the real estate gap, the growing class of Israelis who can afford to outsource everything. Does the DIY ethos survive that? Or do we eventually end up back at the diaspora model, where the well-off hire out and the capable generalist becomes a working class identity rather than a national one?
I think it bifurcates. The ethos doesn't disappear, it just stops being universal. You already see it. There are Israelis who haven't touched a drill since the army, and Israelis who are rewiring their fourth apartment. The difference is increasingly class. Which is ironic, because the original Zionist project wanted to eliminate exactly that kind of class division in Jewish life.
The new Jew becomes a niche rather than a norm.
But I push back on the idea that this is just a return to the diaspora model. The diaspora model was about structural exclusion. Jews couldn't do these things. The emerging Israeli model is about choice. Some people choose not to. That's a different thing. The cultural permission to be capable is still there, even if not everyone exercises it.
In an age of specialization and gig economies, the generalist DIY approach might be less efficient on paper. But efficiency isn't the only value. Resilience is one too. The person who can fix their own leak, run their own gables, build their own furniture, they're less fragile when systems fail or money gets tight. That's not nothing.
It's not nothing. And I think that's why the ethos will persist even as Israel gets wealthier. It's too tightly woven into the national sense of self. You can outsource your plumbing and still believe, deep down, that a capable Israeli should know how to do it. The belief survives the behavior.
The ghost of Nordau haunts the plumbing even when the plumber shows up.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1931, radio astronomer Grote-Verbur's precursor experiments detected cosmic radio emissions from the Milky Way using a homemade dish in his backyard. But 3 years earlier, a British expedition in the Solomon Islands had already recorded unexplained radio interference at 160 MHz during ionospheric tests. Levels that modern analysis suggests may have been an accidental detection of the same galactic plane signal predating Reber's recognized discovery by half a decade.
The Solomon Islands nearly scooped radio astronomy, and nobody noticed for a century.
That's very on brand for this episode, actually. Accidental DIY science.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own questions about history, culture, or the correct way to run Ethernet through a 100-year-old Jerusalem wall, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. Back to the move. If you hear a thud from Jerusalem, it's probably me dropping a drill. Thanks for listening.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.